Welcome, everyone, this afternoon to the Judiciary Committee. Today is Thursday, February 16th, and where's it? Yeah. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. The first bill up this afternoon is Senate File 1586. Senator Limmer, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1586, the committee may remember, was a bill that was, temporarily laid on the table so that different interested parties could greater affect the writing of the bill. And you may recall that this particular bill would establish a felony charge for intentional neglect of a vulnerable adult. There was a number of concern from parties that are regularly engaged in commercial business regarding the treatment of vulnerable adults. They wish to add language to the bill and some comfort language that was established. We allowed the parties to have a discussion for a number of days, and they arrived at a compromise that I have been told all parties concerned were in agreement with. As a result of that, I would like to offer as a delete everything amendment the A8 amendment.
And Senator Limmer, is this an author's amendment?
This is an author's amendment.
Any discussion on Amendment A8? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have representatives from the Hennepin County Prosecuting Office to give a better detailed explanation of the amendment and the discussion that was a result of different players in this field. And I'm going to hand it off to Mr. Dave Brown to begin, and we'll start there.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Brown. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, members of the committee, after our last hearing here, we had an opportunity to get together with all of the concerned parties. These are people that had been interested in this bill for a number of years. Specifically, we heard a number of concerns. We heard concerns about whether the felony law itself was too broad. We heard concerns about whether family members who are unable to reasonably meet the needs of a vulnerable adult would be held accountable. We heard concerns from line workers in facilities about whether they would be held responsible for problems with staffing. We heard concerns from the facilities themselves about whether they would be held responsible for the criminal acts of their employees they didn't know about or did not permit. And finally, we heard concerns about situations that were discussed among this group about the situation where there are two call lights or two patients that need to be cared for and the provider has to make a choice. And so we sat down last week, and our office came forward with a proposal. The provider groups, the unions that represent many of the line workers were present, number of the care provider organizations. And I have to say, on behalf of all of the people that attended those meetings both last week and then again this past Tuesday, there was an enormous amount of work on both sides. And frankly, everybody gave something and everybody got something in this. And I simply wanted to thank all of the people that participated in those. You see a number, I believe, out here, an extraordinary number of letters of support from a wide variety of groups, and that did not come about easily. And it came about because everybody was working in good faith to reach a very thoughtful compromise, and most importantly, a bill that will help protect our most vulnerable adults. So I will turn it over to Senior Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Amy Sweezy to sort of walk through the compromise language that's been reached. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Sweezy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. There are significant ways in which what we have today is different from when we were here 2 weeks ago. The first is that what we've done is take the felony offense completely out of the neglect context and identified it and named it differently and provided entirely new elements for it. It's called intentional deprivation of necessary food, clothing, shelter, health care, or supervision. We did that intentionally to show that what we're really talking about here is deprivation, the actual act of depriving somebody of something, and we wanted to make sure that it was clear that that was what we intended by it. There is also in that element is that the caregiver or operator must be reasonably able to provide those things to the vulnerable adult. That language comes from the child neglect statute. So that is identical to a standard in existing criminal law. What we have then significantly that differs from the gross misdemeanor, which will stay as it is, are two theories under which the felony charge can be brought and prosecuted. The first is that the caregiver or operator knows or has reason to know that the harm can result from the conduct. So we're adding to allay the concerns that intentional neglect was too vague and not specific enough, we've now added that the caregiver or operator must know or have reason to know that the degree of harm suffered could result from the conduct. The second theory under which cases can be brought and prosecuted is that the conduct occurs over an extended period of time. This is meant to address the cases where neglect obviously goes on for an extended period of time, but where the events themselves that lead to the harm are not in and of themselves causing greater substantial bodily harm. The concept of an extended period of time exists already in the criminal law. I believe that Senator Latz had it in some language he was suggesting as well. It also, where I'm most familiar with it is in the child sexual assault statutes, where different crimes have different consequences if they took place over an extended period of time. So that isn't anything new in the criminal code. The exemptions that exist in the current law for the gross misdemeanor, that is the scenarios to which the law simply doesn't apply, remain here. That involves medical decisions, medical directives, and existing consensual relationships. We haven't touched that at all. The penalties are would be a maximum of 10 years, strictly talking about the period of incarceration here, a maximum of 10 years for great bodily harm and a maximum of 5 years for substantial bodily harm. That is in line with other areas in the criminal code where the degree of harm defines the level of punishment. We think that the most important part and the part, frankly, that we worked the hardest on to reach agreement is the part subdivision 2B, which is entirely new language for this statute. And what we have there are three affirmative defenses. And what these are, it's really literally spelling out the three types of situations that we talked about over and over and over again, both in since the legislation was introduced and in previous discussions for years. The three situations in which we don't intend to criminalize the conduct that has to be made because of certain choices. The first addresses the concerns and the situation where you have a frontline worker primarily in a facility. And the first affirmative defense allows that person, if they are able to show that they were unable to make the necessary provisions to provide for the care of the vulnerable adult, thereby preventing the bodily harm that incurs, if they were unable to do that because of inadequate staffing, inadequate supervision, or institutional policies, they would have benefit of an affirmative defense. The second is for the operators, the facility operators, the owners, and those with managerial and supervisory authority in the facilities. And what this one means is that if they can produce evidence that they didn't knowingly, intentionally, or recklessly permit the criminal acts by an employee, they have the affirmative defense. Specifically, what we're getting at here is that it's no one's intention to prosecute the facility itself or the owner or the manager if what has happened is purely the result of the intentional acts of one particular employee. If there's no way the facility could know or should have known, we're not interested in prosecuting that. And then the third affirmative defense, the one that came last in our discussions and our negotiations, was to address the situation Mr. Brown talked about, what we've been referring to as the two call lights at once. And what is intended here is to exempt from the criminal statute the situation where a worker is faced with two patients or residents or vulnerable adults that need help at the same time. Necessarily, you're going to have to make a choice under that situation. And if it turns out you make what I'll refer to as the wrong choice and harm cannot be prevented by that, as long as it can be shown that the worker was reasonably and necessarily providing care to another vulnerable adult, that would not be criminal conduct. So those are the three, basically the factual scenarios that were of such concern that we wanted to make sure that we got addressed both, I think it's fair to say, on both sides. So they're very specific. That's certainly true. But we think that covers the three major areas that were a source of concern that we heard both from the other groups and when we were here last time.
Thank you, Ms. Sweezy. I see Mr. Freeman in the room. Mr. Freeman, did you wish to make any comments?
Mr. Chairman, just to apologize that this new group is not performing according to Senate time. I apologize for being late, but I'm sure that Senator Limmer, Mr. Brown, and Ms. Sweezy took care of it. But I just want to say I support this new compromise. We heard you last time you met, and we went back and made changes that all agreed to.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Mr. Goodnow is in the room. Do you wish to comment, Mr. Goodnow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Goodnow. I'm here representing the Minnesota Home Care Association today. The Home Care Association is part of a more larger informal group of providers that had concerns about the bill, which include the Long-Term Care Imperative, ARM, and the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'm here on behalf of the entire group to say that we support the bill as amended, and we want to thank Senator Limmer and the other folks, stakeholders that were involved with this, in listening to our concerns and working towards an agreement that we can all live with and support. So just here today to express our support for Senate File 1586 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Goodnow. I do have one question for Ms. Sweezy, if you could come to the table. Thank you. Ms. Sweezy, under the felony deprivation crime on line 17, deprivation occurred over an extended period of time. Can you expand on that a little bit as to what that means? And I'm kind of guessing maybe it isn't defined by statute. Is this going to be, in effect, a jury question that a jury would decide what is an extended period of time?
Mr. Chairman, yes, is the short answer. That will be a jury question.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions by any Senator Engelbrecht?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is pertains to the facility and the obligation of the facility, and maybe it's covered in statute elsewhere, but I'm of the belief or the understanding that a caretaker for a vulnerable adult, according to this statute, would be a mandated reporter. Is that correct?
Ms. Sweezy.
If in the facility environment, yes, as opposed to the home environment, I guess, is the...
Yeah.
Yes.
Senator Engelbrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a follow-up. So I'll give you a hypothetical. Should a mandated reporter, maybe it be a nurse or individual employed by the facility, makes it known to the facility that they don't have the means to care for somebody. And that, I guess, for no other terms other than the fact that it falls on deaf ears. Tell me what would become of a facility that would not at least address a mandated reporter's complaint on not having adequate food, not having adequate staffing levels.
Ms. Sweezy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I presume what the direction that the investigation would take place would occur, assuming that we have the appropriate degree of harm to the vulnerable adult to look at charges under this statute. What we would be looking for in our investigation and what we would be asking the police to do is gather the evidence and proof about that, with a mind, even before the case is charged, to whether that affirmative defense would be available on the one hand, the mandated reporter, if they're the person who's ultimately responsible for the harm, we would be looking at it that way. Did that person actually report to the staff? Can we prove that they reported to the staff? That sort of thing. On the other hand, we would have to be looking at whether or not the facility is responsible and whether they would be responsible if it, in fact, fell on deaf ears. So what we would be doing if that scenario presented would be looking from an investigative standpoint at which of those things is true. One of the things we like about the affirmative defense language in it for prosecutors is that it sets it out right away at the time of charging. It's right in front of us for something to look at. So in that situation, you're going to have to investigate because presumably the frontline care worker is going to be saying, this isn't my fault, I tried, and the facility's going to be saying, perhaps, we'd have to investigate that. We had no reason to know that this person was incapable of performing the job. So that's where we would start.
Senator Ingebretz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've got it clear in my mind. I just if the facility were to be not responding to a mandated reporter, I understand the authorities would have to prove that. But there is at least in your feeling, as a prosecutor, you're feeling that this statute would cover the facility if there was that type of a negligence on their part?
Ms. Sweezy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, absolutely.
Any other questions? Senator Littimer, any final? I'm sorry. I apologize. Senator
Mr.
Martin.
Chairman, Senator Littimer, thank you for bringing this back and working out the differences because bill got a little bit longer, but I think it's a good bill, and I think it's helpful when you find out what the concerns are and work on them. So thanks to you and the county attorney.
Thank you, Senator Marty.
Senator Letts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and everyone who's involved in this. I, too, want to commend all of you for working hard on this. I know it's been a long road, and I'm very encouraged by what we have in front of us. I think it's going to protect the vulnerable adults in Minnesota more than current law does, while recognizing that every situation is different. This will target the most egregious situations, and we all wish to do that and to punish people appropriately when they deserve it. So thanks for your work on it.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Limmer.
Have you announced whether a quorum is established yet?
I have announced, and there is a quorum.
One comment I'd like to make, and that's particularly to Senator Letts. Senator Letts, you gave us a little bit of a polite admonishment to come back and do a little bit more work on the bill, and I think we took that advice to heart, and so did everyone that was the early proponents of the original bill, and as a result, I think we have a better and stronger bill, and I'm sure it'll stand the test of any constitutional question as well. Thank you.
Senator Limmer, do you have a motion?
I have a motion that Senate File 1586, as amended, be recommended to pass and be moved to the Finance Committee.
All those in favor of Senator Limmer's motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion passes and it is adopted.
Thank you.
I didn't take note. Far beyond my 15 minutes that I had written.
Always got done voting. This is the next one is the marriage solution, which I don't have a major dog in that.
Halfway through my first cut
off,
and I'm guessing it's
not going to
last.
Good. Okay. Did you get my message? I just ran off the board. Everything's sitting at my desk.
That's right.
So it's been okay for them. Yeah. So I just said
Yeah. Not sure we're there quite yet.
Senator Hall, Senate File 1161 is before us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. The Senate bill before you today is Senate File 1161. Mr. Chairman, this bill updates and I believe improves the current statute for parenting and education of divorced parents. Divorce is a difficult situation for all family members, but particularly for children. The state legislature passed the current law in 1997 in order to reduce parental conflict and help children adjust to the situation. The need for this legislation is the fact that parental conflict in divorce process is known to harm children and increase the burden on our courts. And might I also say that if in any way we can educate prior to filing for divorce and save some marriages, I would be glad that that would happen. So with me is to testify is Dr. William Doherty, the professor of family social science at the University of Minnesota, and also attorney Linda Ray. Do we need to move the authors delete all first?
Senator Hall, yes, we do. Senator Hall moves that Senate File 1161 be amended with the A3 amendment. It's an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Please proceed, Senator Hall.
Okay. So I'll let Dr. Doherty go first.
Right. Yes, Mr. Chair, thank
Dr.
you.
Dr. Doherty,
yes, thank
to
you.
Committee.
I want to begin with the statement from Judge Bruce Peterson, who has been actively involved with this bill and who has 10 cases in his court today that he couldn't be here. He wishes he could.
Dr. Doherty, could you give a more complete identification of you for the record?
Yes. So I'm William Doherty, a professor in the Department of Family Social Science at the University of Minnesota, and I direct the Couples on the Brink project.
Thank you. Okay. Please proceed.
Yes. So this is from Judge Bruce Peterson, who is Hennepin County Family Court. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on this bill. The judicial branch has taken no position on this legislation other than to conclude that it has no fiscal impact. And I write to you today as an individual judge with 7 years' experience handling exclusively family law cases in Hennepin County Court, including 2 years as presiding judge there. I strongly support this bill. Research has made it increasingly clear that divorce can be very damaging to children. And what makes it worse is conflict between parents. Children can be put in hopeless loyalty binds by parents who inadvertently use them as spies. What's mom's new boyfriend like? Or messengers tell dad that I must have his child support checked by Friday. Disparage the other parent. He's late again. You could never trust your father. Or expose them to harsh words or conduct during parental exchanges. I've seen this going on far too often for years. The most cost-effective way to reduce parental conflict is education. Minnesota has an education requirement for divorcing parents with custody disputes, but it's not working well. Evaluation has shown that compliance is low, and even those who take the required class often do so too late in the process to do much good. I've spoken at many divorce education classes at which parents have said they wished they had done this sooner. Two developments now make it possible to significantly improve our divorce education system. The first is the availability of online education resources, which are permissible for the first time under this bill. I was initially skeptical about the value of online classes, but now I have spent several hours working with the Children in the Middle online class, and I've concluded that online education can be every bit as good as in-person classes, if not better. The research supports my intuition on this. Because the participant has to answer questions about a realistic dramatization before moving ahead, there is no way to sit back in the back row and zone out. And uniformity and quality can be assured. High-quality online classes make it feasible to move up the divorce education requirement to a point where it can be easily enforced before the divorce is ever filed. The need for people to have prompt access to the divorce court would prohibit such a requirement for in-person classes, which can require days or even weeks to find, schedule, and complete. But the nearly universal availability of computers means everyone can complete an online program in a few hours if they do not wish to go to an in-person class. And those who have urgent situations can be readily excused from the requirement via waivers contained in the bill. The second development is the statutory establishment and funding of the Couples on the Brink Project at the University of Minnesota, headed by Professor Bill Doherty. For the first time, both in-person courses and online courses must meet standards of effectiveness. Couples on the Brink Project is now available to do that. People deserve ready access to the justice system, and domestic violence victims in particular need prompt access to judicial protections. Given the widespread damage being done to children during divorce, I believe a delay of a few hours to learn basic communication and child protection skills is a reasonable compromise in the vast majority of situations. And I believe thoughtful and workable exceptions and protections have been built into the bill for domestic violence victims and others with special circumstances. This bill would be a very good thing for many children, and I encourage you to support it. Thank you, Judge Bruce Peterson. So now I'll move to a few comments for myself, and these will be just a few minutes.
Please proceed.
I want to emphasize this bill is about children. There are approximately 12,000 children whose parents divorce in Minnesota each year. And we know from the research that parental conflict is a chief source of a chief cause of behavioral and emotional problems for these children, and that high-quality parent education can make a difference. So those we know from the research. This bill improves the current statute in a number of ways. I'll list them briefly. First, it's universal because all divorcing parents and their children can benefit. Second, timely because pre-filing education can prevent delays and mistakes that children experience with their parents not knowing how to manage their relationship, and parents express regret. Third, it's accessible because the online option, in addition to the in-person classes, allows for timely and convenient classes, especially in rural Minnesota. In the current law, which requires only face-to-face classes, there are parents in rural Minnesota who cannot get access because there are only maybe two classes scheduled a year. And we now have, in fact, my whole career on this changed when I discovered the research on online powerful courses for parents, what the research indicates can be as effective as face-to-face. The other part of accessibility is that in this bill, all current parent education programs approved in the state are automatically grandfathered in until September 2014. As long as they add a couple of new curriculum matters. At that point, they will need to produce research evidence of their effectiveness. If we're going to have a mandate, which we've had since 1997, especially if it's going to be universal, we need to make sure that we have reason to believe that these are effective in reducing parental conflict and improving children's adjustments. So there will be a standard now for evidence-based programs. In addition, we believe that this is logistically sound. We've been working on this bill for 2 years with multiple conversations, with multiple stakeholders. Not everyone agrees, and so you'll be hearing from some others. But we've talked to county clerk administrators and divorce lawyers, and we believe that this is a feasible and logistically sound approach. And we've added a module, as Senator Hall talked about, because of recent research where we found that a subset of parents already filed for divorce in the process are open to marital reconciliation. There's a brief module on reconciliation. And finally, I'd like to address two concerns that have come up about the bill and there will be more discussion of, I'm sure. The first is, do the new requirements create undue burden for parents? What we've done with the bill is to have a number of waivers for parents who feel they cannot access an online or in-person class or who have an emergency that requires them to file immediately. The way this is done is that they simply check a box and there is a waiver. Low-income parents simply can declare to the parenting program that their income is less than the 200% of the poverty line, and they will be allowed to take the course for free. They do not have to get a piece of paper from the state to do that. And then the other concern, as I conclude my remarks, is do the new requirements put parents at risk for domestic violence? For parents in abusive relationships where active co-parenting would not be appropriate, there is a waiver that says my spouse's behavior towards me or the children makes it dangerous for me to co-parent at this time. Now, for parents who don't know they're in an abusive situation, because this is sometimes the case, that it may not be clear to that parent, usually the woman, there is now for the first time curriculum content on abusive situations where cooperative co-parenting is not advisable. I want to make it clear that this is an upgrade of the current law. Currently, one of the 20 curriculum topics simply says that the course has to refer to the impact of domestic violence on children. Now, newly approved courses will have to have more substantive education about domestic violence, including times when active co-parenting should not be done. I want to make it clear that nothing in this bill keeps an abused spouse from seeking safety and relief from the court. In fact, as I said, I believe this is an upgrade on the in terms of the domestic violence. Thank you for the time. I look forward to the deliberations on the bill.
Thank you, Dr. Doherty. Ms. Ray, would you identify yourself for the record?
Yeah. Chairman Limmer and members of the committee, my name is Linda Ray. I am a family law attorney with a private practice in Edina, Minnesota. I've been practicing since 1995. I've represented clients in family law matters in all walks of life and do litigation as well as alternative dispute resolutions such as mediation, collaborative law, and early neutral evaluations. Well over 50% of my clients have had children under the age of 18. I'm here today as an attorney concerned about the impact of divorce on parents and children. Just this past fall, I had two cases involving small children that went to trial, one in Hennepin County, one in Dakota County. In both cases it happened, I represented the father, and in both cases it just so happened that the mother was trying to restrict or greatly reduce the father's parenting time. I want to talk for a brief moment about the Hennepin County case as a way to illustrate the problem with lack of education and the potential benefits of the parent education bill. In that case, the child was 2 years old, and although the attorneys and parties used resources to attempt to resolve issues out of court, including a social early neutral evaluation process and a mediation process, they failed miserably. The custody evaluator expressed a strong concern that this child would not do well because of the conflict between the parents. My client asked that both parents participate in a program called the Storefront Parenting Plus program involving four sessions, I think 4 hours apiece. The mother refused, saying that was a strategy merely to look good before the court, and therefore the mother took a parenting class a week before trial. Of course, by that time, great damage to the relationship had already been done. The custody evaluator went ahead and recommended joint physical and joint legal custody with a 50-50 parenting time arrangement because both these parents were good for the child, just not good together in terms of their conflict over the child. And the evaluator found that it would be detrimental to the child if one parent had, or the mother in particular, had sole physical custody. So that was the right decision, but it was based on a foundation that was frankly horrible. In this case, now these parties are done. They have 50-50 parenting time. They don't trust each other. They can't communicate, and they don't have a good appreciation of the impact of their conflict on their child. I firmly believe that had these parties taken a parenting class, such as the one suggested in this bill, before this case started, 12 months before it went to trial, this case would have turned out differently. They would have understood something about the impact of their conflict on their child. With regard to this bill, one of the modules that's being required is a module that explains to the parties what their process options are, from litigation to ADR options such as collaborative law and cooperative law and mediation. Had these parties heard that, I think they would have made much better use of the social early neutral evaluation process and the mediation process that they went through. They would have appreciated how their conflict was impacting their child and had a greater desire to keep this case out of court. I ask that the committee strongly consider passing this bill out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. Any questions from the committee at this point? Senator Newman, I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Ray, I agree with everything I've heard this afternoon from all three of you. I just have one question, and it involves the mandate, the requirement. You must participate, and you know we've had a number of years where it has been mandated. You must participate in these classes, and now we've got a bill, to increase that, and that I agree with that. My question is in your experience in dealing with candidly, a very, very difficult area of law. What do you think, or how well do you believe the mandate is working? Will the parents willingly participate in these programs without seeking a way to get out of the participation in the program? Is the mandate, the requirement, working?
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's an excellent question. I think as a whole, attorneys have a strong sense of professionalism and integrity, and it's our obligation to advise our clients of their obligations under the law, which would include the obligation to take this parenting class. And often it would be the attorneys submitting the parenting education certificate on behalf of the clients, or for those clients that for some reason can't take the class, the waiver. And I don't think there's an attorney that would advise their client to say that there's an emergency, for example, and they shouldn't take the class if, in fact, there's not an emergency. So I do think the bar will view their obligation under the law as officers of the court to uphold this law and to advise their clients to act accordingly.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with you, Ms. Ray, that is what the bar will do. And I really believe that the attorneys that practice in this area of law would literally encourage their clients to participate. What I'm talking about is that difficult client or the couple that they're just not going to cooperate. I mean, they've had a difficult time for an extended period of time, and maybe the line between love and hate has already been crossed. Do you have any sense of what's going to happen in those cases where these folks are required to participate in this class, and they do not fit under the exemptions where the certificate of impossibility is to be submitted. I know it's a hard question, but you know, I know that there are those couples out there that I just question whether or not you can literally order them or force them to participate in something that they're not going to be interested in participating in.
Well, Senator, I think that's obviously entirely fair, and the current law isn't accomplishing its intended purpose, which is to have every single parent, certainly in a contested case, participate in an education program. This bill, I think, fixes some of those problems in requiring a parent to file a certificate of completion before, along with their petition. So that first parent who's filing for divorce, if they're the recalcitrant parent and for whatever reason they say, I don't want to take the class, they're not going to have a choice any more than they can say, I want to get divorced without filing a petition. They're going to have to file either the waiver or the certificate of completion. So I think participation in the education program is going to be increased significantly under the new bill, but it isn't going to force every single person. I mean, we just don't have that kind of ability. The second party, the first party is going to have to file a certificate of completion or a waiver. The second party may never respond, correct? We can get what's called a default divorce, where the second party never answers. And if they never answer and don't file anything with the court, there is no mechanism to require them to take an education class. That's true. But for those parties who do file, they will be required to take the education class, or their filings won't be accepted.
Ms. Hurlatz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A follow-up on that, ma'am. Does that mean that they will not be able to get a divorce in Minnesota if they don't either qualify for the exemption or take the class?
Ms. Wright.
Chairman and Senator, yes. I don't think so. So the first party to file does need to take the class, and if they won't take the class, they can't file. That's the problem. I mean, they have to take the class to get a divorce. If they take the class, they're going to be able to file. If their spouse won't take the class, they can get what's called the default divorce and proceed to get divorced without that parent. And if that parent wants to participate in the process by answering, then they're going to need to take the class. And they're probably going to want to participate by answering. And therefore, they're going to take the class because that's the way they can answer the petition that's been served. So I don't think it's going to keep people from getting divorced unless someone says a four-hour class is more weighty than the notion of getting divorced. I just don't think people are going to find that to be the case. If they want to get divorced, taking a four-hour class isn't going to be an impediment to them moving forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
Yes, and if response to Senator Latz, too, again, there are exemptions here. So, you know, she's saying they would either have to take the course or an exemption from that course, and those were listed.
If I might, Chairman Limmer, the current law requires parties to take a parenting class. We're not doing something that's different here. Every contested case, the parents are required to take a parenting class. So this is simply a mechanism to increase the probability that they're going to follow through on what our current law is.
Senator Latz.
I'm not that familiar with the current law, so you can help educate me here. Under current law, they could file the petition just with the filing fee and the petition, right? And then the requirement to take the class becomes a part of the litigation process. If they refuse to take the class, under current law, could a judge still grant the divorce petition?
I think the question is, can the judge go ahead and divorce them if they don't take the class?
Yes.
The law is framed as a shall. parties shall take a parenting education class. It isn't framed as the parties may take a class if the judge so decides. I think there are judges, and I suspect Bruce Peterson might be one of them, that would say the law requires you to take a class. You need to take a class before I can sign your judgment and decree. I think there are judges who don't do that. I think there are judges who sign off on judgment and decrees and the parties haven't taken a class. That's an enforcement problem. But the law does say shall, not may.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
So I understand a judge has more leverage if they actually are requesting a judge to decide something in the course of the litigation. But sometimes I understand parties would file a petition, or one party would file a petition for divorce, and they get into the litigation, and in the course of the litigation they go through ADR or they continue settlement negotiations, and maybe they reach a decision to settle the proceedings with a division of property and parenting time and so on. And the only additional involvement of the judge would be signing a stipulation at the end of the process, I guess granting the divorce. And so you're saying, even under those circumstances, there are some judges are saying, we're not going to sign off on that unless you complete the current required course. And there are some other judges that will either ignore it or will determine that they don't need to impose that requirement, even though the statute says so. And there might be some arguments for that. I don't. But now what you're saying is, under this bill, they couldn't even get into the courthouse unless they've already met this class requirement, right?
Unless they have a circumstance that would allow them to have it waived, an emergency, they can't access the online course, they can't get to an in-person course, they're concerned that they have an abusive relationship and co-parenting is not something they should be doing. So there are opt-outs so that they don't have to take the class under those circumstances.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
No question.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to just go back to the beginning when you introduced the bill and the purpose of the bill. I hear a lot about what the parents are going to have to do and what the parents won't have to do, and I've been working on some similar things. But could you repeat why we're going to require this bill? I think we lose the kids in some of this, that these situations for these kids are extremely stressful. And unless parents can actively participate in reducing some of the conflict between the two of them, even in a bad situation, we know that divorce is going to happen. But the kids are who end up being the victims here. So maybe we could touch on why it would be so much better to have them do it at the beginning of the process instead of at the end.
Thank you,
Dr. Doherty.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator. The holy grail of preventing problems of kids in divorce is high-quality preventive education early. That's the holy grail. People who do this work, and you're going to hear from Jeff Olson, who does terrific work around parent education, all wish that parents got access to this early, not late. I've done research on a couple thousand parents, Hennepin County, and the average parent takes the classes as the last thing they do before the dissolution. They overwhelmingly love the courses. A 90% or higher satisfaction with it. Most of them are required to do. Most parents say, I wouldn't have done it on my own, but I'm really glad I did. So this is a justification for making people do something, okay, because they like it at the end. But they wish, there are two problems. One is they wish they had done it sooner because they're making mistakes. I would do this, I'm not blaming them. I understand this is very difficult stuff. They're making mistakes early on that they can't undo. And then the second thing that has been mentioned is that because so many judges are not following through on this, the number of couples where both parties take it, we estimate in Hennepin County is less than 30%. And in rural Minnesota, it would be even less than that because the courses are so unavailable. So the other thing that happens in the classes is people say, I wish I had this sooner for the sake of my children. And secondly, I wish my spouse, soon to be ex-spouse, also took the course because then we would have some common language and some common frameworks. This bill moves us in both of those directions quite a lot.
Thank you.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, I very much interested in this. I mean, when former Senator Dill started talking about this, I'm thinking 15, 20 years ago, I think it's an important thing, and I like Dr. Doherty's move. I agree with the desire to push it earlier in the process. I think that's very helpful. I think the online stuff can work good. My concerns, I brought in Judge Peterson and Dr. Doherty and met with former Judge Kloss and some of the domestic violence advocates, and I'm concerned that this bill is like the Limmer bill of a few weeks ago, that it's might not be there yet. And what I want to say about that is that I think that this parenting education is really useful in a lot of cases, and maybe 90% said they really appreciated the course when they took it. They wish they hadn't taken it so late. I think that's important. And whether it helps in 2% or 80% of the cases, at least make the proceedings be less confrontational and so on, that's great. But if there's 1% or 10% where they're hurt by it, that's my concern. And I guess I look forward to hearing from some of the other witnesses to hear concerns they may have. But, like, for instance, when we talked earlier, we talked about the inability to pay for it, and I was looking and didn't see it until I got to the third page on the cost being waived. If you make less than 200% of the federal poverty guidelines, then you can go to the program and tell them, hey, I need you to waive it. The program gets to decide to do it. There's no out for that. There's, and I know 4 hours may not seem like a ton of time to you or me, especially in a big thing like this, but you have a young parent with two kids, young kids in tow, and, well, I could go to the library and find 4 hours to do this, maybe with two kids in tow, maybe not. I guess I'm just concerned, and I guess I'll wait to hear what the reactions of others are, but if it helps in 80% of the cases, but in 5% of the cases it makes it more dangerous or more harmful, this is one of those cases where I think two sides sitting down, I think there's been progress made in the last year or two. And I really do want to encourage this. I just think that I'm not sure you're there yet, and maybe we need to wait and hear from the other witnesses. But I guess my basic question is, do you feel that when Senator Latt says you wouldn't even be able to, you'd never have a judge be able to do it, and the fact that I said, well, I'm actually over 200% of poverty, but you don't understand these expenses we have, and I can't afford the $40, and the program won't waive the fee, or something else. Ms. Ray, you were mentioning how emergency, you think an attorney's not going to recommend a client put down an emergency if they don't have one. I mean, I agree. I'm just worried about somebody who's scared to, with or without an attorney, saying, I don't know. Not sure it's an emergency. It's just, I can't handle this right now, whatever. I guess I'm curious. I mean, what is your response to the cases where people are worried about this and don't know whether they can handle it right now, or they don't have the money, or they don't have the time, or whatever?
Is your question directed at me?
For either Senator Hall or either of the two witnesses.
You know, I would first say again, the current law requires a parent education class, certainly in cases that are contested, and those classes cost money. I don't have the dollar amount, but I am pretty sure it's $40 or more. So the proposed bill doesn't change that. If a parent says, I've got two kids in tow and there's no way I can get to the library with my two kids for 4 hours, and by the way, I'm having a hard time buying groceries this week and coming up with $40, even though I'm just over 200% of the guidelines, is too hard for me, they can say I can't take the class and sign that affidavit stating that and get a waiver of the class. You were saying, well, is a pro se party going to know that? I mean, that's a hard question. Pro se parties don't know a lot about the law, right? They don't even know how to file for a divorce, let alone how they handle a parent education class. And so our court systems and other entities, legal aid offices, do the best they can to help educate them. And that would fall under there. You know, we certainly in Hennepin County got a wonderful staff there that provides support to pro se clients every day of the week, I think, except Wednesday, and they can get their questions answered.
Mr. Chair, could I just add one thing to Senator Marty?
Yeah, and then we're going to move on to the other witnesses.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Senator. There is one good study, Senator Marty, on whether parent education increases domestic violence. Did not find that. So I think that overall we're not going to find an increase in domestic violence. And we have some waivers if people do think they are in difficulty. So I hear those concerns. My belief is that we've adequately, over the last 2 years of conversations, dealt with these to the best of our ability, and that I'm not sure waiting another year is going to improve it.
Okay. We're going to move on to the other testifiers who wish to speak on this bill. And perhaps they could approach the table, Rob Hahn and Melinda Hugdahl, Jeff Olson, and Andrew John and Katie Bernhagen. They don't all have to be at the table at the one time, but why don't we start with Rob Hahn first and Melinda Hugdahl. Mr. Hahn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senators, I appreciate you taking the time. I'll try to keep it as brief as possible. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill because, to me, first and foremost, it's a conflict and violence reduction bill that'll aid the children of divorcing parents and their parents by giving the parents tools to know how to deal with times of conflict, to recognize problems before they occur, and to, frankly, avoid making the same mistakes that I made during my divorce process. A few years ago, I was a couple months into the divorce process when my now ex-wife and I got into a fight, started as a verbal disagreement, ended up physical. I made a grave mistake, and I was wrong. The next day, I called and voluntarily enrolled in the Domestic Abuse Project in Minneapolis, a great organization, and began to learn firsthand the realities of domestic violence, what it is, what constitutes it, what its repercussions are, both legally and on family members. And it was not until 2 or 3 months later that I actually began taking the required parenting courses that are part of the divorce process. And even though we were supposed to enter into them within 30 days of filing, neither my ex nor I started them until about 6 months into the process. There were some advantages, some things learned from taking those courses, but on the whole, I felt they were kind of a joke. They didn't deal with the harsh realities of divorce, the emotional toll it takes on the two spouses, and how to keep that from your children. And that's why I'm here today, to talk about the value of this bill. I can't say unequivocally that I wouldn't have made the same mistake that I did had I taken a course prior to filing, but I certainly would have had the information and could have chosen to act with more prudence. This bill is stout for two reasons. Number one, and I've alluded to it, because it requires that divorcing couples take 4 hours of courses before they even file, before there's a chance for a bad situation to get even worse. Furthermore, as others have testified already, but I want to second it, this bill includes a tone that will address what I call the dark realities of divorce, the emotional tolls, the roller coasters, how to recognize potential hot-button situations and make sure you can get away from your soon-to-be ex before they evolve into some type of incendiary situation, to make sure that both partners know the realities of domestic violence, its punishments, what it constitutes, how it affects the children. This is a bill that we'll hear over and over today, and rightly so, that is first and foremost about the children going through a divorce. It's not their fault, and they should receive as much attention in a positive way as possible. And courses like this will give parents the information needed to hopefully make right decisions. It's not going to be an end-all, one-size-fits-all answer to the problems, but it certainly will help in a number of situations. To those who support this bill, I say thank you for having the vision to support such legislation. To those who might be wavering, hopefully there are a few, if any, I say consider this. It's not a partisan issue. It shouldn't be a political issue. And in reality, It's a bill that will reduce domestic violence. It's a bill that puts the children first and helps their divorcing parents in an otherwise very, very difficult time. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you, before you leave, could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry.
And if there's an organization that you're representing.
Yes. Rob Hahn. I'm a divorced dad of two, small business owner in St. Paul, and I have an organization called Reform Family Law Now, which is essentially a website that helps convey information about family law matters here and beyond.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Hugdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Services Advocacy Project. I want to thank Senator Hall. He and I have been having some conversations over the last couple of days. And really, where our concern with the bill lies, and I think it's been alluded to already a little bit, is our concern is there. It's a limited concern to make sure we're ensuring access to the courts when people need it. It's not to exempt people from parent education completely, but it's really looking at those opt-outs that have been discussed already with the committee. And in our opinion, that we could improve that to make sure that folks who might suffer harm if they don't get relief from the court in a timely way, that it's clear who qualifies for those exemptions. So really there are three categories we've looked at. To kind of frame this, however, this is really when people probably are first going to learn about this is when they come to the court counter. They have their paperwork with them. They want to file for the divorce proceeding, or perhaps they want to respond to they've been served. And so that's when this really is going to come to the forefront for probably a lot of people is when they come to the court counter. And the court clerk under the statute, proposed statute, will inform them that their paperwork cannot be accepted for filing until they either complete the course or if they qualify for one of the exemptions into the statute. So I think all of us agree and would tell you this is a very emotional time for almost every family that goes through this process. Probably every family that goes through this process is a lot of stress on families, including a lot of financial stress. That's something we have a lot of concern about as well. A lot of families have significant debt issues. They have mortgage issues they need to have dealt with right away. And the families who fall under the exemptions, under the terms of the bill, can still be required to do post-filing education. I think that's important to remember. If you fall under an exemption, you can still qualify for post-filing education. So I want to be clear about that piece of it as well. The other part of it, before I get into the three kind of groups of folks we're concerned about, is that when somebody comes to the court counter and we give them a sheet of exemptions, we feel really strongly that we should say what we mean on the sheet. We have the discussions here, and there's discussions about intention, but when somebody comes to the counter, what's on the sheet is what they understand of what people mean. And so our intent is to make this as clear and straightforward as possible so when people come to the window, they understand what the exemptions are and what they're intended to cover. So with that, I will kind of get to the three categories. And the first one is really a person who cannot complete the education requirement pre-filing because they'll miss a filing deadline. And probably the best example of this is a person who has just been served with divorce papers. It's maybe the first time they found out that they're actually in a divorce proceeding, which is a huge shock to a lot of people. They have 30 days to file an answer. If they go through and file a pro se packet, that packet currently on the court's website is 12 different documents, and the instructions are 24 pages long. So people already have some paperwork to look through before they can even get their paperwork together. If someone comes to the court counter to file that and they are close to that deadline particularly, the court can't accept it. Our concern is if they can't complete it before the 30 days runs, they're in default. So those are some folks that we think it's a reasonable exemption to add that a filing deadline would be missed if they could not complete the course. Also, if there's a situation where in their district, for reasons that the online class may not be an option for them, there is no in-person course available in time either to meet the deadline. So that's kind of one category of folks we are concerned about. The second is people who can't pay the course fee and also can't get a waiver. Under current law, when you file, you can also ask for what's called informa pauperis a standing, which is a court fee waiver order that typically happens at filing. So by moving this to pre-filing, those folks don't have an order yet waiving the course, or waiving their fee, excuse me. So at that point, they are contacting the provider saying, I understand I'm eligible to have my fee waived. Our concern is that there may be providers, especially if they're only doing online coursework and they have no presence in Minnesota other than that, of them saying, well, we don't recognize that. The situation is then the person can't do the course and they can't file, and there's no remedy for them to be able to resolve it. They're stuck kind of in this chicken and the egg scenario. The third category of parents we're concerned about is people who can't complete the course in time to avoid a financial hardship that needs remedy from the court. And really the best example is that someone who comes in, they are filing their paperwork, there's a delay of course openings where they are, which happens now. There's still delay because there's, as I understand it, going to be, at least initially, one course, in-person course available statewide. But if they have to wait, your time to start asking for temporary relief from the court doesn't start until you file. So if you have to wait to file, you're pushing that clock even further back to get relief from the court. And if you are behind on your mortgage payments, if you need to get financial arrangements with your former spouse settled by the court temporarily, you're pushing that timeline back. And we're concerned that folks are really going to have irreparable damage done if they can't do that. So those are kind of the three categories. Our intention would be just to we think it could be covered by clarifying the exemptions. We're not trying to exempt them from parenting education completely. I know that there's been discussion about the online and couldn't this all be remedied by just taking an online course. I went and looked at the Children in the Middle website to see what their requirements were. When you take the class, you have to do this online. And so the registration, you sign up for a 30-day subscription with them. And it's, I think, right about $40 to sign up for the course. But before you take the course, you have to be able to print, download and print two booklets that you use before you take the course. So it's, you have to have it kind of planned out. So our concern is the folks who say, well, maybe they could go to the library and do it. It does have a little more work. That it also, the one provider, as far as I know, I didn't see anything in there that had accommodations for persons who might have a disability or a limitation of doing it online. People might have a language barrier. I know that the intention of the bill here is to try and cover it. We're just saying that I think there are some clarifications that could be done to make sure those who are going to suffer some harm if they can't get relief get covered and they can take that class post-filing. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Latz, and then we have two more witnesses.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I wonder if either of you could address the question, particularly Ms. Hoagland. Sounds like a requirement would be a computer. If you don't have one, you have to find a library that has one. That'll let you print stuff out. You'd have to pay online, $40, so you have to have a credit card or a debit card. And I know from my own law practice, a lot of people don't have credit cards or debit cards. And I wonder if there's been a conversation about some kind of a discretionary waiver of the pre-filing requirement, maybe by a signing judge. I know in Hennepin County there's a signing judge there 5 days a week. I'm not sure how it works in a lot of the other counties, especially in greater Minnesota. But some kind of a pre-filing waiver that would still impose the post-filing requirement. That's an option or been thought about.
Ms. Hogdell?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I did want to be clear just for a thing. I still agree with you, but I do want to couch it in saying that when I looked at the Children in the Middle website, they do recognize an informa pauperis order. Under this scheme, however, people won't have the order yet. They would be contacting Children in the Middle saying, I'm telling you I am low income. And so that's where a little of our concern is. I think Dr. Doherty has the best of intentions of wanting programs to require that. The fact is there's no remedy for people if a program says, well, we're not going to recognize that.
Dr. Doherty, I'm going to ask you to answer this specific question, but I've got two more witnesses, and I've got two more senators that have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is very, very important. The programs have to be approved in Minnesota. The courts, the Couples on the Brink Project will send out a list of approved courses. So they will have to be able, they will have to honor our law. People won't be randomly picking an online course around the country. The courses will apply to be approved in Minnesota. And some of those courses have ways through money orders, checks, other sorts of things, Senator Latz. These online courses have been used all over the country, including with a lot of folks with low income, and have worked out mechanisms to handle those kinds of situations where people don't have credit cards. The other thing I want to say is that people who run up against deadlines, who have financial emergencies, they can say, I have an emergency that does not allow me to do this, or I cannot get access to a class online. So the reason why we hear the concerns, and our only disagreement is that we think that those are covered in the current waivers.
Thank you. I'm going to move on to Jeff Olson, and then Andrew John and K.T. Bernhagen. Mr. Olson?
Yes. My name is Jeff Olson, and I supervise the divorce education programs at Headway, which is formerly the Storefront Group. We've been offering the classes for the last 14 years since the 1997 law, and have served 18,000 families in that period of time under the law. We come tonight as a partial supporter of the law, of the revision to the law. We think, however, that this is a win-lose situation. Here's the wins. Earlier education through pre-filing, yes. Greater accessibility to the information online, yes. Inclusion of reconciliation information, yes. Potential greater compliance, we've been fighting for this for 14 years. Increased quality control possibilities, always. Here's the losing parts, in our opinion. Loss of the interactive, interpersonal aspect of parenting education and the process that we knew intuitively and now have gotten information from parents on what they think about this. If you look in your packet, I've sent both a letter about this and a summary of 579 parents who have taken our classes. The question is, would your co-parenting education experience have been similar or different had an online alternative been offered? How? We did this since April of last year, 579 responses. 14% say it would have been similar had it been online. 86% said it would have been different had it been online. The common themes that I compiled of these different responses, you can look at in your packet, but they're largely the personal aspect of being in a class, a group setting, receiving the interaction of facilitators and other parents and the value of that. I included, just for your own reading, 14 pages, which is all the data. These are all the comments by the 579 parents. The other loss that we see in this is the loss of community-based service providers. There have been people who have been committed to this process for the 14 years and therefore would lose out if just an online alternative were to be offered. We would like to see a win-win. We've begun a pilot in Washington County for 11 months where we're doing a blended learning option where people take 4 hours of online followed by a 4-hour in-parent class. We would like to see this bill expanded, and it's our only reservation about the current bill, that an in-person post-filing required provision in the bill would make a win-win for both of the losses that I identified there. This is also in the letter that I sent to you, to each of you. Let me illustrate. A divorcing parent is like a dehydrated person, an empty glass, who doesn't know it because they're frustrated, angry, confused, sometimes hopeful, but they have a lot of coping, surviving skills, but they are depleted relationally, spiritually, intellectually, and often physically and financially. This legislation points to the problem and offers them information and good solutions, partial hydration. But it is mostly through the human-to-human interaction, as pointed out by the parents who have attended our classes since last April, that full hydration can happen. So what we would like to see happen, you might ask, there is an in-person alternative here. It's contained in the bill, read the bill. So why would we be concerned that people wouldn't take the course pre-filing in person? Our experience in 14 years and 18,000 people have been that dehydrated people choose the easiest route and will probably drink half of the glass willingly rather than the full glass that we're talking about. Our fear is that the more convenient, less personal route taken by this bill will lead to only partial relief rather than what is needed for them to become responsible parents in a new setting. So we would be fighting for an additional option where the four-hour online would be followed post-filing by a four-hour in-person class. If we only get a chance every 14 years to look at parent education, let's do it right this time.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Andrew John and a K.T. Bernhagen.
All three of you want to sit here? Okay. I should sit over there.
Do you want to chat?
I'll slide over.
Please proceed. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Yes. My name is K.T. Bernhagen, Chairman Limmer, and members of the committee. I am here today to ask the Senate Judiciary Committee to not pass Senate File 1161.
Yes. Hold the microphone real tight and speak just a little louder. That would be helpful.
All right. I apologize. I'm here to ask you not to pass Senate File 1161. I am a divorced mother with three minor children, and I am the victim of domestic abuse and stalking from my ex-husband. I've had orders for protection against my ex-husband since 2007, and most recently the court issued a 10-year order for me. I went through a divorce through Hennepin County in 2007. While going through the divorce process, I attended various counseling programs for myself. I also attended programs with my children. And I'd like to say I chose to go through those programs. My ex was forced to go through those programs, and further on down the line, after going through multiple programs, he still lost his time with the kids because of what he did to them. These programs were helpful to me and my children, but they were helpful not because they focused on how to co-parent with my ex-husband, but because they focused on risk management, safety, and how to parent in a way that would optimize my children's future. Because my ex-husband engages in stalking behavior, I work very hard to keep my information private. I drive through my neighborhood to make sure his car is not there. I change my driving patterns in case he's following me. I am very careful not to give out a lot of personal information, especially where I am or what I'm doing. My children do also do not disclose information. To share information is to risk my safety and my children's safety. What is proposed in Senate File 1161 scares me. If such parent education requirements had existed in 2007, I would have been forced to remain in my abusive relationship, or I would have simply had to run away rather than turn to the legal system to assist me and my children. If I had gone through a parent education program like the one talked about in this bill, and I believe the information in it, it is quite possible that I and the children would have remained in the relationship and would have been hurt or killed. Abuse is not about love. Sorry. It's about power and control. And two of the things that abusers use against their victims are money and time. This bill gives control to the abuser to maintain contact and control over the victim. And I don't believe that was the intent of it. My children and I have a right to be safe. The court should be somewhere that we can go for safety and assistance. Because this bill did not exist during my divorce, I was able to graduate with honors with a BS in communications and business, and I now run my own company. With this bill, I would have probably ended up in a battered woman's shelter or dead. I ask you to consider the potential harm that could be caused to domestic violence victims and the children by a bill like this. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bernhagen. Jeff Olds. I'm sorry, Andrew John.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could you identify yourself for the record and if there's an organization that you represent?
Certainly. My name is Dr. Andrew John, and I'm the Associate Director of Therapy at Domestic Abuse Project, and I'm here at the request of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Chairman Limmer and other senators of the committee, I have been at the Domestic Abuse Project for the last 10 years, and I've been providing individual and group counseling to perpetrators of domestic abuse, women who have been the victims of domestic abuse, and the children who have experienced domestic abuse in their homes. I really believe that education is an important resource for families, but that parent education must take into account issues of domestic violence. If victims and perpetrators of domestic violence are given information about reconciliation, about co-parenting after divorce, and this information is not framed around safety issues, it is likely that it can be used as another tool of manipulation and could be very damaging. For families where there is domestic violence, the primary concerns are not on communication and co-parenting. The primary concerns focus around safety. Is it important to keep children out of the middle of disputes? Absolutely. But the kind of education that might be appropriate for families where there is no violence or controlling behavior is not going to be appropriate for families when domestic violence is present. My concern with Senate File 1161 is that all parents are sent through the same education classes that are not focused on domestic violence and safety. There are elements proposed by the requirements that are harmful when involved with domestic violence situations. Families experiencing domestic violence need the access to the courts, they need to be directed to appropriate services, and they need to be given resources that address their specific situations. And this bill does not appear to do that. And I ask that you not pass Senate File 1161. Thank you,
Dr. John. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair.
And one thing I may want to add, we have 7 minutes in this room before another committee comes in. So,
Mr. Chair, one quick question for Dr. John and then maybe another comment. Dr. John, you were saying that some of the things in the course, I looked at some of the online course things and so on. It looked like it was good stuff that would help a lot of couples, but I wasn't looking at it strictly through the example of Ms. Bernhagen or examples you mentioned. Could you give an example of something where you said it could be dangerous to be presenting it the way it's presented and so on? The co-parenting, I assume, instead of what you're saying is they should be trying to figure out how to be safely away from rather than trying to co-parent. Is that the issue?
I would say safely away from there. Some of the language in some of the education appeared to talk about ways to control conflict and places responsibility on both parents to try to control conflict when there is high conflict, which there often is in divorces. But in domestic abuse situations, especially like the one Ms. Bernhagen talked about, you can't control someone else's behavior and the kind of psychological damage that can happen not only to victims of domestic abuse but to children as there's this attempt to negotiate a diminishing of conflict when an abusive person isn't going to choose to do that. That's what could be harmful and damaging. And the suggestions made by some of the curriculum is about this is what you both are supposed to do. This is what you both are supposed to do. And in domestic violence situations, there's a different course for someone who's abusive versus someone who is a victim, even if both engage in conflict.
Sir Marty.
Mr. Chair, then maybe my comment would be that I think this bill will help a lot of families, and I think it's good to move it forward, and that's why, again, for the last 10 years, both with Senator Dill earlier and Dr. Doherty and others, but I also have concerns. I don't know if it's 1% or 10% or whatever percent where you're increasing the risk, and I guess I think the example of what happened with the previous bill where laid it over and the sides worked it out, and again, I brought one meeting together between the coalition and Dr. Doherty and so on. I just wonder if that would be an appropriate thing to do here as well, where we lay the bill over and they work on it and try and address it. Because, I mean, when I read the third exemption here about my spouse's behavior makes it dangerous for me to co-parent at this time, somehow that co-parenting struck me as not the right word you'd be using in an exemption like that, because I don't think the issue is, in that case, co-parenting. And I'm wondering, Senator Hall, what you're thinking about that, because I think it would be very helpful if people would sit down and keep working it out, because I don't want to have it where it helps a lot of families but could be fatal in some. And it was just a week or two ago the coalition had its annual clothesline project thing, and I don't know, it's 30 or 40 deaths a year in this state, and that's a heck of a lot of people dying from these sorts of things. And even one or two, you know, it helps a lot of families avoid conflict, but one or two, it ends up the wrong way. I just think that this is one that's crying out even more so than the previous bill to work until we can get everyone together, because I don't think there's any difference between what the last two witnesses said and what Dr. Doherty and Senator Hall want to do. I think it's a question of the fact that they're coming at it from two different perspectives, and let's not make it better for most people and much worse for a small number, but let's try and figure out a way to work out the differences. And that doesn't mean next year or anything. It might be 2 weeks from now. It might be next year. But, I mean, Dr. Doherty, you and I have been talking about this for 10 years, and I appreciate the progress that's been made. I just am concerned that in order to do it right now, we're going to brush off some very serious consequences.
Senator Limmer, and I'll be very brief, Senator Marty. This is a substantial improvement on the current law. It's going to require, and so I have to disagree with my colleague here, that this is not the standard curriculum that are out there. This curriculum will require education about domestic violence, risks, and situations in which active co-parenting should not be done. And Senator Marty, if I thought, I'm going to be really honest here, that another 2 weeks or 2 months or 6 months of conversations would get us to agreement, I would do it. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that at the level of a population intervention, it's impossible to rule out every possible situation where somebody does not understand they're in an abusive situation, where they don't exercise their rights, where the fact that the curriculum says be wary, be careful. I don't think we're ever going to get there. I just think we have to move ahead.
Senator Hall, in 1 hour, we've covered a lot of ground and raised a lot of questions, and I'm not sure if we have a lot of answers yet. I certainly can appreciate the bill that you're attempting to create, and I think there is certainly a place in Minnesota statute for this bill. I'm getting a sense from the committee that they have a lot more questions, and I'm also sensing that the committee may be wanting a little bit more buy-in on a more universal basis. And I know you've worked very hard on the bill, and I know that Dr. Doherty's been here many years, but I think you're getting really close. But I have to ask the committee where they want to go because we have to leave in about 2 minutes. Unfortunately, we've just plain run out of time on a very involved issue. So we'll see where the committee wants to go. Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hall, I agree with Senator Limmer. I would like an opportunity to visit with you about this bill. I do have some thoughts that may be helpful to you. And I would ask that you take the recommendation of Senator Limmer.
Senator McGuire was first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really do appreciate your indulgence on this issue, and I appreciate all the work that Dr. Doherty and Judge Peterson and all of the groups have done. And, Mr. Chair, you gave us such a great example of the first bill on the agenda of how, you know, opposing sides can try to come together and maybe not get exactly what they want, but really try and make it work, you know, for the betterment of the citizens. So I also have encouraged them to work together, and I would appreciate it if they would continue to do that. I know it may seem difficult, but I hope they'll take the lead that you had in the first bill that we passed. So I'd like to see more time. I also, if we don't take more time, I have some questions that I'd like to ask. But I know we don't have enough committee time.
Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, I would echo my colleagues. Domestic violence was the number one killer in St. Paul. It was bigger than gangs. It was bigger than drug deals. It was the most significant lethal event that happened in St. Paul during my tenure as chief and for years before that. As a consequence, I am always very cautious about erring on the side of the exception, not necessarily the rule, when it comes to domestic violence. I've got a lot of questions on lethality assessment. I like a lot of what I hear that's gone into this. But we spent a lot of time trying to protect victims at the front end when they got to the court process. And this seems like there's some exposure here that I would not be completely comfortable with. I think there's some work to be done here. I think there's some work that can be done here to close some gaps, to perhaps give them some sense of where lethality assessment could happen at an early enough stage so that victims could have kind of the red flag, even if they didn't necessarily know there should have been a red flag. And I'd argue for some additional consultation and work on this.
Senator Harrington, thank you for those comments. Senator Hall, you know that I like this bill. I'm a co-author of the bill. And I very much would like to at least advance this idea still this session. But now with T-minus 3 minutes past the deadline, I know that the committee has a number of directions and inquiries that they still want to advance. I think it's a bill that's certainly worthy of public discourse, and we should do this. We do have a rampant divorce rate. It is not healthy for our culture to have this high of a divorce rate, and that as a result, this is one opportunity to maybe slow that pace down. But it appears as though there's some unanswered questions to put comfort into the committee to advance.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And at this point, we are out of time. I would move to lay this matter on the table.
There's a motion to lay the bill on the table.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carried. There's no further business before the committee. We're adjourned.
I lost my voice.